We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is The Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Sociologist Janet Poppendick sees in our concerns about overweight children an opportunity to provide kids with better, healthier meals at school. She says we should focus on hunger, public health, and the environment. Janet Poppendick is the author most recently of Free for All, Fixing School Food in America. She's been studying school food in the U.S. for several years. Here are some of the questions she set out with. What are school meals like today? How did it get that way? What are program administrators and concerned communities doing to improve them? And those are some of the questions we'll focus on this afternoon. Janet Poppendick is our guest. Listeners, you can join our discussion with your thoughts. I look forward to your questions and comments. Join us by phone or by email. The email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. Janet Poppendick is a professor of sociology at Hunter College, City University of New York. In addition to Free for All, she is the author of Sweet Charity, Emergency Food and the End of Entitlement, and Breadlines Knee Deep in Wheat, Food Assistance in the Great Depression. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. WILL-talk@illinois.edu if you'd like to join us this afternoon. Janet Poppendick, good afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
At the outset of your book, you say this is the time for school food reform for these reasons. Hunger's on the rise, our children's health is deteriorating, and the environment is under assault. Here at the outset this afternoon, beginning with hunger, the reason you came to this project, would you offer us a thumbnail profile of each of these issues?
Okay, I'm happy to try. Starting with hunger, I think that many people are now aware that the hunger numbers are sharply up. Every year, the Department of Agriculture conducts something called the Household Food Security Survey. And for years, the numbers would fluctuate, up a percentage point or down a percentage point. In the last survey, the numbers rose dramatically so that an additional 13 million Americans were reporting food insecurity, household food insecurity. That does not always mean that children are going hungry, but it means that their household is at risk, on the edge of hunger at any time. But unfortunately, the most dramatic rise in the last number was specifically among households reporting that children had gone an entire day without food, the sort of most severe indicator that we measure. So the numbers are up. It shouldn't come as a surprise, given the depth and intensity of the recession. Recession hits young families hardest. Those are the people who've been at their jobs for the shortest amount of time, so they're the first laid off, and they've had less opportunity to accumulate assets or a cushion. So very often it's the parents in our society who are bearing the brunt of the recession, and it puts our children at risk. So reason number one to do the very best that we can with school food and all, really, of the child nutrition programs is because our children are at risk. The second part of my argument for why now is the time is that, in fact, all of the research that's been done suggests that our society is eating less and less healthily. We're eating more and more highly processed food with lots of unpronounceable ingredients and lots of salt and sugar and fat, and less of the fresh produce that we need. Now, I think there's been a real growth in awareness, in consciousness. I think many more people are taking a critical look at the way they eat themselves and the way we all eat. But it's not easy to change your habits when the enticing, heavily marketed, brightly packaged treats are everywhere, you know, at arm's length. I mean, they're all around us. And the fresh produce is harder to get, particularly in poor neighborhoods. Study after study has shown that only a tiny minority of our children are eating the number of servings of fresh fruit and vegetables or whole grains that are recommended by the government's food pyramid. So even if you're not focused on the outcome that we can see, the rising rates of diabetes, the substantial increase over the last decade or so in childhood obesity, rising rates of hypertension among children, of artery clogging and various forms of damage that are associated with obesity. If you look at the diets, you know that we're going to pay a price for this in the long run. So that's the health argument. And the environmental argument really has to do with the size of the endeavor that school food represents and the possibility of using school food proactively to move our food system in the direction that we would like to see it go. If people would like to see more fresh produce, more food consumed close to where it's grown, okay, more locally grown food, more food that's raised by sustainable methods, so without pesticides and heavy doses of fertilizers, organically or near organically, and as I say, sustainably raised, here's an opportunity to move our food system in that direction. The National School Lunch and Breakfast Programs combined provide 7 billion meals a year. If you've changed your food habits because you wanted to take better care of the environment, you're responsible for 1,095 meals a year if you eat 3 a day every day. But collectively, we're responsible for these 7 billion, and we could use them if we could change our attitude toward public procurement from what's the cheapest to what's the best for our society. We could use this to reduce our carbon footprint, to promote the restoration of the fertility of our soil, to make rural communities more economically sound, and basically for a kind of renaissance of medium and small farms that could supply local food sheds.
Mm. You mentioned some of your misgivings, a couple of misgivings early in the going in Free for All about jumping on the childhood obesity bandwagon, and I think they're worth mentioning. What are they?
Well, I think that whenever we talk about obesity, we typically tap into a sort of personal responsibility framework that most of us are carrying around in our heads, and it's a good thing that we carry around in our heads personal responsibility frameworks. We are responsible for the choices we make. But children, I think, are less responsible for the choices they make, particularly when they are subjected to so much advertising. I mean, as a society, we have not chosen to limit the advertising of food to children in the way that some of our counterparts across the ocean have. So our children are really exposed to hundreds and hundreds of hours of advertising for foods that are not particularly healthy for them. So to operate in a framework that says, well, you know, you should exercise more and make healthier choices, is possibly counterproductive. It aggravates guilt and anxiety, and a lot of us, when we are feeling guilty and anxious, snack. So that's part of what I meant by saying that I was reluctant to jump onto that bandwagon, because I think as soon as you mention obesity, you're sort of calling forth the sermon on personal eating habits, whereas what I think we need to change immediately is the school food nutrition environment. The other reason that I articulated as in terms of having a concern about that is that I don't want to be part of the chorus that's making people who are heavy, for whatever reason, feel like outcasts and outsiders in our society. We have major problems with young people in our society with dieting too strenuously. You know, the extreme cases are anorexia, but you don't have to go as far as anorexia to have young people striving for unrealistic and often unattainable slimness. So I don't want to be part of the chorus that encourages that.
Yeah. You began your research in the kitchen of a high school cafeteria. You spent a week there. Where was the school and how did you choose it?
Well, I'm not going to tell you in specific terms where
okay.
it is, because I do want to protect the privacy of the folks who were so generous with their time to me. But it was in a small city in a large northeastern state, and it was a relatively modest-sized school. The numbers are not my primary thing, and I can't at the moment recall the size of the student body, but it wasn't a huge mega high school. And I chose it partly because of access, partly because I visited the school as I was looking around, just trying to get oriented to this whole school food phenomenon. And the school food service director in that school was very welcoming, very free with his or her time. And not averse to the idea of my spending some time there, whereas many other directors that I had spoken with felt that would, you know, that I would be in the way. So it was partly a matter of access. And as I said in the introduction, when I went there, I certainly didn't imagine that I was going to write a chapter that was almost a blow-by-blow account of my time there. It really was, I wanted to get oriented. I wanted to be able to ask good questions when I met with school food service staff.
And at the end of the week, one of the things you had learned was this. There was a published lunch menu that was pretty good, but it was not the de facto menu. What was the de facto menu?
The de facto menu was typically chicken nuggets or chicken patties, some form of potato. The fryer was down the week I was there, so they were using what I think of as tater tots. I've had some discussions with lawyers about whether that's a copyrighted, a trademarked term, but everyone knows what you mean if you say tater tots. But a tater tot-like product that was actually a federal commodity. And burgers and pizza. That was the great majority of what was consumed.
And when you talked with the food service director about this, how did he answer your questions?
Well, he expressed a lot of frustration. He had done a number of experiments with healthier menus, healthier combinations, and he felt that the kids wouldn't eat. You know, that if he served salad with pizza instead of fries with pizza or other forms of potatoes with pizza, that the kids would either not select the salad or if they took it on their plate, wouldn't eat it. That's not what I saw in high schools and middle schools around the country. I won't say that students were always eating the salad, but when the salad was fresh and attractive, I saw a lot of students eating salad. So I think some of this was his particular point of view. Some of it is a widely shared mantra among food service directors. Mm-hmm. They are pretty tired of having those of us outside the schools who don't know what they struggle with in terms of constraints on a day-to-day basis telling them how to improve their menus.
Yeah, they've got a tough job to do. And somebody else said to you something like, look, we can't be trendsetters. We have to feed these kids, and there are some things they just won't eat. So that gets to the question of how do we in our communities, beyond schools, work to turn that around?
Well, I think it's important for your listeners to understand that in addition to whatever is the federally subsidized official school food menu of the day, in most middle and high schools in the United States, the food service is also selling items a la carte, and they are doing this because they need the money to break even, because the combination of reimbursements for the youngsters who eat free and reduced price meals and the much smaller reimbursement for youngsters who pay the so-called full price and the prices that schools feel they can charge for the school meal is not enough to do the job. So all over the country, with limited exceptions, you find schools selling items that they believe students will buy. And these are, you know, kids' favorite foods. And so, again, we're back to that advertising. These are the foods that children and young people have developed a taste for. So it's not when the food service director says, oh, they won't eat that, he or she doesn't necessarily mean they wouldn't eat it if they were hungry and that's what's available. He means they won't eat it when, as an alternative, they can get, I think the thing that got to me most at the kitchen where I spent the week was a pretzel with nacho cheese sauce on it. you know, if they can get things that they love and that they've been trained by our economy to think of as their favorite foods, then they probably aren't going to go for a healthier stir fry, even though they might really enjoy it. So I think it's important to understand that it's not that the official school lunch is almost never the only thing available to youngsters in the cafeteria. And then if you take the larger school as the nutrition environment, there are vending machines. Mm-hmm. There's often a school store. Many schools allow the youngsters to leave it at lunchtime. So then there's the 7-Eleven and the Burger King and the McDonald's and the gas station convenience store. So it's not a situation where the healthy food is competing with an empty stomach.
Yeah. You use the words develop a taste for. And one of the things you write about in this book, Free for All, is the change food has undergone. And one reason for the change is farm policy, which you report has made corn and soy cheap, thus lowering the price and raising the profit margins. You want to talk about that?
I think it's really important for your listeners to understand that public policy is very much implicated in the way our food system has changed. By subsidizing corn and soy production, which we do to, you know, the tune of big bucks traditionally in the United States, we have indeed made them cheap to produce. And when they became very cheap, then the food manufacturing industry began inventing ways to use them and investing in the, you know, the whole process of designing and creating new foods and the equipment infrastructure that processes them, investing in that whole system for products that rely heavily on corn and soy. And corn typically in the form of high fructose corn syrup, and soy often in the form of something called soy isolates. Together, these ingredients contribute to a long shelf life for a packaged good. You know, those best if used by dates on things? Well, the longer the period that a product can be on the shelf before it's going to reach that date, the more opportunities there are for it to be sold at a profit. So things that created these long-lived packaged foods, corn and soy also contribute to texture that people find appealing, to an appearance. Very often we get things that look you know, as if they've recently emerged from an oven. I'm sure many of your listeners have had the experience of being disappointed by something that really looked good when it was wrapped in cellophane, but didn't taste so great when they took it out. But that appearance of having been recently baked is another of the genius of the corn soy industrial food complex.
Mm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today is sociologist Janet Poppendick. She's the author most recently of Free for All, Fixing School Food in America. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. You can join us by email or by telephone. Email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-WILL. Let's take a call from a listener in Peoria on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon. Good subject. You know, I kind of laugh at this subject to begin with. I know this is going way back, maybe in the dark ages or something, when I used to be in school. We had these vending machines, and we had that you know, the typical cafeteria food. And it seemed to be fine. The vending machines, of course, so they had all the, you know, the, what do you call it, the Hostess pies and whatnot in there. Of course, that's not good for you. But kids, if they're given money, aren't going to go and buy the things that are nutritious. And unless you can get all the garbage food out of the school system, it isn't going to change the kid's mind because it's habit. You know, to me, you know, you can, this, all this stuff is well and good, but unless you change the school district's lunch menus, and that seems to be the hang up with a lot of school districts. And I know it's affordability, you know, maybe we should just cut it all out and let the families take care of the situation. I don't know. I know there's not, there might be a lot of people out there that have kids that go to school that can't afford to make the kids school lunch, so they just let the school lunches, you know, themselves take care of them from the school district themselves. But I don't know. It seems like, you know, with all the stuff you're talking about, it's all fine. Like, again, it goes back to the situation. Habits are hard to break.
Well, I want to thank you for your comments, and you've given us a couple of areas here that we can explore. Dr. Poppendick?
Well, you know, really what he's saying is a very large part of why this book ended up arguing for universal free school meals. I know it's a controversial proposition, but let me lay it out there. If the meals were free to all students, in the first place, they could be integrated with the school day and they could be integrated with nutrition education, which would certainly be a plus. But the most important thing is then you could get rid of all of these competing not-so-healthy foods. I agree with him that when kids are given money, they are very likely to spend it on the treats, again, that they've been led to desire through the advertising. So I'm suggesting we take money at that level out of the picture. Now, I'm very aware that there's no such thing as a free lunch, and I'll come back to that in a moment. But at the school level, I think we shouldn't be selling food to kids. They're required to be in school. They're there over the meal period. I think the meal should be part of the school day. I had a chance to observe this in Sweden, where meals have been free to all school children since the 1930s. And it really is different in the cafeteria. There's no cashier, so the lines move much faster. There's no stigmatizing of children who get the free meal. And consequently, the meal itself, the program, is not stigmatized. This is a normal part of the school day, part of what's happened in the United States. Because we have this three-tier thing with free, reduced price, and what are called full-price meals, although, as I say, those meals are also the beneficiaries of the federal subsidy. But because we have that system, and because kids, when they're especially in those sort of middle years, are looking for ways to distinguish themselves from others, so they're really ready to jump on any distinction of that sort, first the children who need to make use of the free and reduced price meals become stigmatized. And this is severe enough that children, as they grow older, will often refuse to participate. They would rather go hungry than be seen by their peers to be recipients of a free meal.
Yeah. Well,
but then the program itself, the food itself, becomes stigmatized. That's the county food or the welfare food. And that drives the kids who have money out of the regular food line and often to, as I say, the convenience store or the 7-Eleven.
Yeah, or the fast food restaurant.
Right, or the a la carte line in the cafeteria where they can flash their cash.
Mm.
Show that they...
Yeah.
So the argument for universal free... This has been going on in the United States for a long while, where anti-hunger advocates for years have said it would be better to do this on a universal basis because the stigma is undermining the intent of the program. But what I saw as a new opportunity with the concern about health and childhood obesity was really that I think that selling food to kids keeps us from using school food as a vehicle to expose kids to healthy food.
Hmm. One of the reasons you went to Anytown High School was the percentage of students eligible for free and reduced price meals. How many were eligible and how many took advantage?
You know, if you wanted an answer to that question, you needed to have told me in advance that you were going to ask it.
I understand completely. Right. And you know what? I'm sorry. My apologies. But anyway, it makes the point, doesn't it? I mean, some kids are eligible and they don't want to go there.
Right, absolutely. I'm just leafing through my copy here to see if I had those figures in the description of that chapter. My recollection is that I really don't want to mislead readers. Why don't we send readers to the bookstore or the library to check it out for themselves? One thing that I did have a chance to see in Anytown was a universal free breakfast. They were experimenting with a universal free breakfast in a number of their schools, and the participation rate jumped dramatically when the breakfast was served free to all.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. Is it me?
Yes, that's you.
Okay, a couple things. I have three kids in the school district, so I'm very familiar with the lunch opportunity and so forth. And a couple things. They have destigmatized it, at least in the Unit 4 school district, because all the kids are assigned a code. Now, you can walk up to the goodies line or the regular lunch line, and you put in your code. If you choose, you can give cash, but nobody knows if your parents deposited $50 in your account or if your account is free or reduced because it is just a code. So it's personal. And, I mean, kudos to Champaign-Urbana for doing that, or Champaign at least. But it has been destigmatized in our area at least by doing that. So have you seen other schools do that?
Quite a number of schools are doing it, and it's an innovation that, you know, has been spreading across the country. Of course, it requires a pretty hefty investment in both hardware and software to make it work. And I agree with you that it reduces the stigma, and maybe when we get a generation of kids who've never had the old system, the stigma may be reduced quite dramatically. I was excited when I learned about the code or PIN number, and some schools are actually using biometrics, so it's a finger imaging. The child puts her finger on a pad, and that calls up her account. But I heard from school food service directors so many reports of problems with the system, the biggest problem being something that they call low balance, but where indeed the parent has deposited $50 and thought that that would last for a certain number of weeks, imagining that the child was going to buy the school lunch each day. But very often the child was buying additional items a la carte, or treating friends or what have you. For whatever reason, the balance ran out. Parents had not replenished it, and school food service was confronted with a situation where the child's account was going into deficit. And many of them, school districts, were reporting hundreds of thousands of dollars in losses due to uncovered meals. Once the child has eaten the meal, it's proven difficult to get parents to pay.
Right. I see that too. And unfortunately, you'll hear a teacher go, "So-and-so needs. You need to tell their mother that they need to put money in their account, or it's overdue." So I think that privacy is lost there. But for the most part, I think we have a pretty amazing district because we can. You can put in there, my child can only spend $2 a day, and they'll code it in $2 a day. Or my child can only get one. In the middle school time, my one son, one of three bags of chips.
Uh-huh.
I could have them code in there. He can have one bag of chips.
Uh-huh.
And that would stop, that would limit it. And so maybe we're just ahead of our time, but I think our school district in itself has done a really good job of that. But in addition, what's frustrating is, even if you qualify, say, for a reduced lunch, and the teenager still doesn't want the reduced lunch, they want to go have a cookie and, a potato chip, what I mean? So,
right. Well, that's why I think we need to get the cookies and the potato chips out of there because, I have a sweet tooth myself.
I'll tell you, that might have worked on my boys, but on my girls, if you have a picky eater,
uh-huh,
and she won't eat them the whole day, and I have a sugar reduced, even if you send snacks in her backpack and whatever, I would rather her have a bag of chips to stabilize her throughout the day because they just won't eat. And then you've got from, 8 o'clock in the morning until 3, you get this cranky kid. You're like, what happened to you? Did you not eat? Well, I'm not going to eat that junk. So honestly, when you say get it out of the school, I don't think that's realistic. They just won't eat. And then you'll have not healthy children with nothing in their blood sugar. So anyway, that's my comment, and I appreciate it. I'll just listen.
Right. Well, it's exciting to hear that about districts that are doing, doing well within what's currently possible. And there are terrific experiments and practices that work all over the country. I don't want to minimize them. The computerized coding system obviously is going to work best in communities where parents are involved and there's good communication between the school food service and the parents. But when you talk about the kids who, would eat nothing, I'm thinking, well, are American kids really fundamentally so different from Swedish kids? Because I sure didn't see kids in the schools in Sweden who just weren't eating. I think it's a culture that gets created. And in our schools, we've created a culture where there's the official lunch and then there are the goodies for sale. And I think that if we were to take a fundamentally different approach where school food became part of the school day. I don't think that kids who are currently, juniors or sophomores in high school are going to change their habits. But as we bring up a new generation, if a healthy meal was part of the school day and everyone was eating it, or nearly everyone was eating it, there weren't alternatives around, I think a lot more youngsters would eat it. I don't think, we'll ever totally avoid the teenage food rebellion.
Let's take another call, a listener in Urbana on line 2. Hi.
Hi. I'm just delighted that you have linked these topics together, the nutrition and environment, and would like to talk to you for hours about that. But one just comment that I want to throw in the mix, and that is I see so much consumption of white flour, white pasta, white bread, white crackers, and sugar, mostly sugar. I mentor a child at the Urbana Middle School who brings her own lunch. What does she bring? Sugar this and sugar that and white crackers and some more sugar. So anyway, it's appalling, and we're working on it and making a little progress, but I would just like to hear your caught. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Well, again, you know, the white meals, I saw a lot of monochromatic meals that were sort of golden. There would be, you know, a chicken patty or chicken nuggets and a roll, and if you had fried potatoes or potato puffs as the vegetable, you've got an all-gold meal there. And I think that, in a sense, I guess I agree with Michael Pollan about nutritionism, that as we've gotten more and more caught up with assessing meals by technical lists of nutrient values, we've kind of lost some of the common sense that certainly my mother had, my grandmother, that a meal should be colorful. And that was one way she made sure that, you know, we were getting a variety of the foods that we needed. It's worse when it's white, because typically the way foods get white is by the removal of important parts of them. I think we're making progress. In schools have, in New York City, we use whole wheat bread now in our sandwiches. When it was first introduced, they did half and half, sandwiches made with one slice of white bread and one slice of whole wheat, and then eventually they converted to all whole wheat. We are using whole grain pasta, but it looks white. So we're, I guess you could say we're sneaking some of those whole grains in. I do think that in our culture, we've gotten, I think there's a craving for blandness sometimes, that maybe it's the overall stress level makes us want comfort foods as our normal intake. But I do think, any monochromatic meal ought to be an alert.
Yeah. It was interesting. Yesterday on Morning Edition, there was a report about from Radiolab, which is an NPR program, where they've done some experiments where the more stress you're under, you're more likely to go for chocolate cake rather than fruit salad.
And it makes sense to me, because when we're under stress, we feel a little sorry for ourselves. Often. And I think we want to take care of ourselves, not in the health sense, but more in the consolation sense. It's kind of, oh, poor me, I need a treat to balance this, whatever it is, this stack of papers I have to grade or what have you. So it doesn't surprise me. It makes intuitive sense. But, of course, it's really too bad, because it's precisely when you're under stress that you need the best nutrition.
Mm. Janet Poppendick is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of Free for All, Fixing School Food in America. My name is Celeste Quinn. We have a few minutes remaining in this portion of the program. If you'd like to join our discussion this afternoon with a question, a comment, give us a phone call, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You can also join us with an email question, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, besides universal free lunch, what else would you like to see in our schools in terms of fixing school food?
Okay. Well, I would like to see more local procurement, and I have a whole host of reasons, environment being a primary one, but I also think it's easier to get children to eat the fresh produce if it's truly fresh. I think it tastes better when it's traveled less. So I would like to see more emphasis on local procurement and really on the integration of the school food procurement with the local economy. And I'm happy to say that changes that were made in the last child nutrition reauthorization now make it much easier for schools to do that. There used to be provisions in the federal law that made specifying a local origin in a bid for procurement illegal, and now it's gone pretty much 180 degrees, so it's actually encouraged, and it's certainly permitted. So that's one item, is local procurement. Local procurement often starts with a food service director looking at the menu and thinking, well, is there anything here that I'm getting from far away that I might be able to get from closer to home? People who are working on this would like to move that mindset a little more to what can we grow in our region and how can I feature that in my school food menu? So more of an integration with the regional food system. Okay, so that's one thing I'd like to see. Another thing I'd like to see is more fresh preparation of food on site. And I know that there are many schools where that's not currently much of an option because they simply don't have the kind of kitchen equipment that allows for cooking. And they don't have the staff who are trained to do that kind of cooking. But we're in a recession where we really need jobs. And we need jobs that are compatible with child-rearing because we have lots of households in the United States with just one parent trying to do both the breadwinner and the child care role. And school food jobs have been and can be, again, those jobs that are on the school calendar and the school schedule and, therefore, really good jobs for parents. So I would like to see us invest in equipment, training, create career paths, reinvest in a school food workforce that's more than just, you know, defrost and reheat, and school food equipment that's more than a box cutter, as one of the food service directors I interviewed put it for me. I would like to see the cafeteria thought of as a classroom, as a part of the school day. There's a little bit of a black box mentality, you know, kids go into the cafeteria and they come out the other end and something has happened in there and the principals mostly don't want to know much about it because they're overwhelmed already. But I think if you look at human history, the mealtime has always been a primary locus for the socialization of children into our values and into health. So I'd like to see more emphasis on the educational potential of the school lunchroom.
Yeah, an opportunity for social interaction and to practice civility.
Right, exactly. And, you know, I don't think it's an accident that so many of the sort of teenage movies feature food fights in the cafeteria. I think the way we have treated school food as sort of something to be gotten out of the way in 20 minutes, if possible. I mean, the school lunch hour has been shrinking and shrinking. It communicates an attitude that I think we really need to reverse.
Yeah. Well, that's another way your title works, Free for All.
Yeah.
It works both ways, doesn't it? It works in terms of free lunch, free universal lunch, and food fight.
Yes.
So let's take another call or two here before we have to wrap up. Listener in Urbana, line one, hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I would like to comment about the time for meal period being so short and kids want to have something they can eat quickly and are... things that we can eat with our hands can be eaten quickly, and many of those are pizza and tacos and so on. Also, in the 70s, I had kids in the elementary school, and I was a volunteer helper. And I saw kids who brought their own lunch, throwing away apples and oranges and bananas and sandwiches. And I would ask them, wouldn't you like to take this orange home and eat it on the way home or after you get home? No, they didn't want to have anything to do with it. What do you do about that sort of thing?
Wow. Well, you know, again, I think that the schools probably can't solve it all, and I do think we need to intervene at the level of the amount of advertising, food advertising, that's directed at children. But it's very interesting. One of the things that seems to be true in elementary schools all over the country is that if you'll cut the fruit up, the kids will eat it. That they're daunted, certainly, by a whole orange. I mean, I don't think I learned how to peel an orange effectively until I was pretty well along. But even by an apple, and some of it is problems with, you know, with teeth, with dental health, but some of it is just if picking up an apple and eating it isn't a part of the sort of subculture of your family, So here in New York, we've been doing a lot with quartered or sliced apples, and the kids seem to take to them much better. They're just more manageable. I'm sure there were other issues that were involved, you know, and it's normal for many children to have a fear of unfamiliar foods. The psychologists have a name for it. They call it neophobia, and they even have an explanation rooted in evolution that in our distant past, when a child became old enough to walk, if they didn't have a fear of unfamiliar foods, they probably ate things that were not good for them and didn't survive to pass along their genes. But in any case, it's something that developmental psychologists observe at about age 2. It sets in. You know, kids who were tasting everything with enthusiasm when they were 18 months old at 2.5 don't want anything that isn't real familiar. It's not true of all children, but it's true of many children. And it hangs on until they outgrow it. And part of the way they outgrow it is sharing foods with other children in, you know, comfortable settings with encouraging adults and repeated exposures to the unfamiliar food. So I know we don't want to think that apples and oranges are unfamiliar foods. And certainly if these were apples and oranges being sent from home, we would think that they were familiar. But nonetheless, we have learned a lot about how to get kids to try foods that are new to them.
Yeah. There we have to wrap it up. We're out of time. Janet Papendick, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity.
My pleasure. Janet Papendick is the author of Free for All, Fixing School Food in America. The book is published by the University of California Press. It's 1:53, standing by with settlement prices from Kansas City and Chicago. Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. In Chicago on this Wednesday afternoon, futures finished the day lower. Nearby contract in the soft red winter wheat pit down 10.25 today. The high price for that March at $4.95. It ranged to a low at $4.83, with a settlement 10.25 lower in the March wheat pit. May futures now, $5.08 the high, the low at $4.96.75. Settlement price at $4.97.75, down 10 cents for the May wheat in July. The harvest month from Chicago, $5.20 the high, the low at $5.08.5, settled $5.09.5, down 10.25. September futures, a $5.25 settlement price, a dime lower. In Kansas City, where they trade hard red, March contract lead option, a 9 cent loss today, $5 the high. The low at $4.90, settled just above that 10 cent trading range bottom at $4.90.5. Once again, down 9 cents for the March hard red winter wheat in Kansas City. Back in Chicago, corn pit now. March contract down 4 cents today, 363.5 the high, the low at 58.25. Settlement price at 358.25, down on its low, 4 cents the loss. May futures at 374.25 top, bottom at 69. Settlement price at 369.25, down 4. And July futures 383.75 the high, the low at 78.25. Settled at 378.5, down 4.25. September corn 391 the high, the low at 385.25. Settled on that low at 385.25, down 4.25. In December futures, the new crop harvest month in the corn pit, $3.97 the high, the low at 392. December corn, 391.75. Settlement price down 3.75. The March contract there at 402.25, a settlement 3.5 cents lower. March oat futures at 228.75 on their settlement down 3. The May at 237.5, 3.25 lower. Soy complex now, nearby March beans, 946.5 the high, the low at 28.5. Settlement price at $9.29, down 18.5 cents. May futures 955.5 the high, the low at 38. Settlement price at 938.5, down 18.5. In July, 962.5 the high, the low at 45.25. Settlement price at 945.5, down 18.5. In the August, 953 the high. The low stated at 940.25, not correct, though, because there's a 939 settlement price, and that's lower than the low. Still, 18 cents lower on its settlement price in the August beans. September futures, 934.25 the high, the low at 24.75, settled on that low down 14.75. In November beans, the new crop harvest month, 929 the high, the low at 14. New November beans at 915.25. down 14 cents on the afternoon. March bean meal futures, 286.90 the high, the low at 280.50. Settlement price at 281.30, down $6.10. The May at 274.50, $6 lower. March bean meal futures at 36.74 high, low at 36.20, settled 36.32, down 45 cents. And the May contract at 36.77. May soybean oil, 46 cents lower on this Wednesday afternoon. During the closing market report, which is just a bit more than, or rather less than 10 minutes away now, we'll talk with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
And now let's take a look at the livestock contracts and how they fared today. Cattle finished lower on the day. Lean hogs were higher. February live cattle, the high 85.80, the low 85.15, the settlement 85.37.5, down 15. April, 89.62.5, the high 88.80, the low, the settlement 88.97.5, down 35. June, 87.75, the high 87.02.5, the low, the settlement 87.20, down 25. August, 87.35, the high, 86.72.5, the low, the settlement 86.92.5, down 25. January feeder cattle, 96.75, the high, the low 96.52.5, the settlement 96.65, unchanged. March, 99.30, the high, 98.10, the low, 98.52.5, the settlement, down 45. April, $100.60, the high, $99.55, the low, $100 even, the settlement, that down 37.5. And May, $101.10, the high, $100.20, the low, the settlement, $100.57.5, that down 25. February lean hog, $67.10, the high, $65.95, the low, $66.57.5, the settlement, that up 10. April, $69.35, the high, $68.30, the low, $68.95, the settlement, up 27.5. May, $73.50, the high, $72.65, the low, $73.40, the settlement, up 30. June, $77.20, the high, $76.40, the low, the settlement, $76.95, up 15. February, pork bellies, $83 even, the high, $81.40, the low, the settlement, $81.70, that finished up 30 cents on the day. The Dow is currently off 2 points at 10,192. The NASDAQ is up 10 at 2214. The S&P 500 two higher at 1,094. Nearby crude down 95 at 73.76.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Friends of WILL and from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. This Saturday's wine tasting features 10 pinos from around the world. More information is available online at thecorkscrew.com.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3, Urbana, online at will.illinois.edu. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our technical director this afternoon is Jason Croft, the producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. At 2 o'clock, 28 degrees in Urbana. The forecast for Illinois and Indiana.